Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has brought uncommon intelligence and great, great courage to various aspects of this war for the free world is our first guest. I'm very proud to say a friend of this program, a man greatly admired, I know, by our audience, and always a welcome guest here. His name is Congressman Scott Perry. He represents the people of the 10th District of Pennsylvania with great distinction. He has also been a member of the Army National Guard of Pennsylvania for many years, rising through the ranks to that of Brigadier General. He is now retired and has been active both in uniform and subsequently on national security issues broadly defined, and we can't thank him enough for his service to our country, both in uniform and out. Congressman Perry, it's great to have you back. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio once again.
Frank, it's great to be with you. Thank you so much. There's so much going on. I hope we can get right into it because China's not wasting any time.
Well, we are going to talk a bit about China first, and I thank you for your willingness to do so. You're one of the few people who I know in public life who is really seriously studying the nature of the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it poses to us. And I thought I might start by just asking you about its doctrine of unrestricted warfare, which it has been waging against us at least since 1999. How would you describe for our audience the nature of that doctrine and its application, sir?
Well, it's exactly, quite honestly, what the name portends, unrestricted. So in the mind of the Chinese Communist Party, and it's important to make that distinction from the Chinese people that are under the boot of the Communist Party, but in the mind of the Chinese Communist Party, nothing is off the table in their quest for world domination. And so while we might like to think of, well, they would like to be first economically, which is true, for sure. But it doesn't exclude things like using fentanyl and flooding the southern border in our country with fentanyl to achieve that means. It doesn't restrict them, or they're unrestricted in meddling in our neighboring states and countries, like the recent assassination in Haiti of the president there, where just coincidentally, I think a number of maybe 11 of the co-conspirators in that assassination showed up at the Taiwan embassy to be arrested, to further besmirch Taiwan's name, to, quite honestly, Frank, the origins of the coronavirus that has gripped the world in a pandemic for a year and a half. I wrote a piece, well over a year ago now, outlining how that likely, the origins are likely from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, not some wet market, not anything to do with bats, but associated with gain of function research at that facility, and gain of function to be used as a bio weapon against its adversaries. And also, Frank, it's important to point out that China has been pursuing and studying the use of ethnic bioweapons. So what that means is that they're studying the genomes of American citizens or citizens around the globe, and they use things like these these, I want to be careful here because I don't want to name any particular company, but if you do your ancestry on your family, they use your genes to determine, you know, what your background is. And China has the greatest gene repository on the planet because they're looking to see if they can vanquish their enemies by making them sick based on their genetic background. So Americans would get sick.
A highly targeted use of biological warfare,
China,
in other words.
Unrestricted in everything it does to reach its goals, including the theft of intellectual property, spying on America, the Belt and Road Initiative, using their telecom industry to gather information, spy on the United States, use it against us, use it against American corporations. There's just no limit to it. And Americans have to wake up to the fact, which is why, as you know, Frank, I've introduced a bill in Congress to label the Chinese Communist Party as a transnational criminal organization, because that's what they are. These are criminal activities that are forbidden by the rest of the civilized world, yet we're allowing them to do them right out in the open, right in the sunshine of daylight.
I want to come back to the TCO designation, Congressman, because I think this is such an important initiative, and I really salute you for it, but I want to get into it a little bit more in detail. One of the other things, as you know, that has been a hallmark of this unrestricted warfare, Congressman Scott Perry, is information operations, the use of propaganda, the use of media, their own and others, to disseminate disinformation about their activities, notably in the Wuhan virus connection. We're going to be talking later in the program with Michael Pack a little bit about how we have, allowed this sort of thing to penetrate our own agencies and information outlets. But I'm interested in your thoughts about how groups like the Confucius Institutes and, you know, Global Times and the journalists who are wined and dined in Beijing and brought over for fellowships and the like to influence essentially our perception of the Chinese threat. How is that playing out?
It's playing out right before our very eyes. And we have in Congress even written letters where the Communist Party has bought and is responsible for the programming of radio stations in the United States of America. And of course, they want to paint everything that the Communist Party does in a favorable light. Of course, we've seen the movie industry in Hollywood kowtow to the propaganda of the Chinese communists. And, you know, if the movie portrays them in a light that is unfavorable, then, you know, the sponsorship is with.
And Congressman, you were talking about the influence China exercises in Hollywood as another example of the kind of unrestricted warfare that it is waging against our country. Your colleague, Congressman Chip Roy, has recently introduced legislation aimed at trying to prevent China from simply buying up parts of the United States. There was a famous incident recently of a large tract of Texas down by the border and adjacent to one of our sensitive military facilities. It's a little unclear where that transaction stands at the moment, but talk about this as another example of the unreciprocated arrangements that China benefits from, and we have no similar capability to participate in there.
Yeah, China doesn't reciprocate at all. They have all kinds of students that are working in research universities here in the United States, everyone a potential spy, because people don't know this, but China has a requirement that the Communist Party has a requirement that when someone comes from China to study abroad or work abroad in the United States, they are duty bound by law to report to the intelligence and gather the intelligence on whatever they're doing. So that's how some of the intellectual property gets transferred and you know, illegally. And then you have this purchasing of prime real estate and assets, of course, close to military bases. But then also the recent news of them setting up a solar farm on one of these huge tracts of ground, which then gives them access to the electric grid of nearby places, to producing rail cars, which have RFID tracking chips in them so that they know, if we're moving military or other material around, and they can control that. So people don't realize how much it's not just TikTok and it's not just the phone that you hold that is being collected on, but every single thing that we do in the United States is monitored by the Communist Party of China, and its propaganda used to control our viewpoints of the Communist Party as they seek global dominance.
And cyber techniques are being used as well to wage war, to gain information, data, and the like, but also apparently ransomware attacks have had as part of their provenance, at least the Chinese Communist Party as well. So this is really comprehensive, whole of society, unrestricted warfare against the United States in the furtherance of what they've actually declared as a people's war against our country. But Congressman, I want to take advantage of your expertise in military matters. You've served, as I said earlier, with great distinction in the uniform of the United States Army, a lot of combat hours in rotary wing aircraft, I believe, and some fixed wing as well. You have a perspective, I know, on the kinetic warfare potential of China as it is evolving. Talk a little bit about that and whether you fear, as many of us are now increasingly concerned, is perhaps an imminent conflict with China.
Well, unfortunately, China is signaling, and of course, the time will be right for them to subsume Taiwan. And this has been going on, as you know, Frank, for a long time. I mean, Jimmy Carter gave away our strong allegiance with Taiwan in 1979, and it's only gotten worse. China seeks to isolate Taiwan, and of course, they're building the Navy, the largest Navy on the planet now, belongs to China. And, and of course, they threat the whole region if they do subsume Taiwan and the Taiwan Straits and the shipping lanes, which is what they seek to do. And of course, based on the party Congress with Xi Jinping and based on the weakness that is being displayed by the White House and the indecisiveness displayed by this White House is encouraging China to do that. Just recently, Taiwan opened up relations with Lithuania and to set up essentially a consulate or that type of operation there. And China is furious over it, and because they seek only to close those kinds of operations and isolate Taiwan as they move militarily, if necessary, to subsume that island nation, which is sovereign. They won't allow them to participate in the World Health Organization. They won't allow them to participate in free trade arrangements that are particular to the region. We are on very delicate terms right now with the Communist Party as they flex their muscles. And unfortunately, diplomacy, we always want to stand up for America, regardless of who the president is. But I think, the most recent town hall meeting with the president shows a cognitive problem there, and Americans see it. And, we don't want to call out our president in the face of the Chinese Communist Party, but they're watching what's happening, and they know that there are opportunities as long as we're not prepared to defend the allies that we have. And I think that's unfortunately the circumstance that we find ourselves in currently.
Well, and on top of all of that, they have deeply compromised Joe Biden, and it seems a fairly substantial number of his senior subordinates as well. But to your point, Congressman, we're talking about the threats to Taiwan. They're becoming more and more explicit and backed up by exercises of military capabilities. There have also been threats to nuke Japan serially, as a matter of fact. And there seems to be a growing proclivity to position the Chinese Navy and its missile forces and the like for action, even perhaps against our own forces, whether in Japan or elsewhere in the region, or maybe even Hawaii, for that matter. When you look at all of this and do it again in the backdrop, as you said earlier, of biological warfare attacks, both those that seemingly have already happened with COVID and those that may be in prospect, tailored, we're told initially the plan for this illegal biological weapons program was to depopulate the United States so that it could be colonized by the Chinese Communist Party. These are truly mortal threats to our nation, to our survival. And do you sense among your colleagues an awareness of how serious this problem has become?
I do sense a growing awareness, Frank, but what I don't sense is the urgency to really take action. And for instance, the Senate is is proposing essentially something, a bill that would be the sense of the United States that Taiwan should have a collaborative agreement with the United States and the National Guard in the United States. That's an opinion. We need to be taking action. China is taking action right now. And the things that you talk about, while they seem fantastic and potentially just unbelievable to the American people that these things would ever take place, these actions are taking place right now. Japan is considering what would happen if China moves militarily on Taiwan, and what that means for Japan and their cooperative agreements. They would feel compelled to defend Taiwan militarily, and so these are real, these are serious, and unfortunately, with the Democrats, especially in control in Congress, we're paying lip service. So we like to pound our chest and rattle the saber, so to speak, but we don't really intend to do anything about it with the Democrats in control. And, you know, it just goes to show part and parcel with the bill that I have, labeling the Communist Party as the transnational criminal organization that they are. The Democrats won't even discuss it, let alone co-sponsor it, or, you know, if they think it needs to be stronger, or they want to discuss amending it or what have you. I'm certainly willing to discuss it. They're not even willing to discuss it. So it's rhetoric. While we're talking in the United States, the Chinese Communist Party is taking action to reach world dominance, even moving, as you know, Frank, their timetable up. They're moving it up because they think they can achieve world dominance even sooner than their 100-year anniversary.
Yes.
And they're taking actions to do it.
49 to 2049. Congressman, much more to talk about on that front, but let me switch gears, if I may, because I think we've let with our audience a pretty powerful impression of the challenges that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party and what we need to be doing about it. And your work on this transnational criminal organization initiative is vital in that regard, because I think, among other things, it would properly characterize the nature of the danger we're facing, yes, but also create impediments to those in this country who seek to help the Chinese, because they would, after all, become accomplices to criminal activity if they were to do so. Let me ask you about one other thing, though, that's top of mind at the moment, sir, and that is the commission that Nancy Pelosi is putting in motion now to investigate the so-called insurrection on January 6th. I'd be very interested in your take on whether, in fact, it was an insurrection and whether we're likely to get any real clarity on this, or whether this will just be another example of political warfare instruments being brought to bear against us.
Well, I would have to say, first of all, it was certainly the weakest insurrection you could ever plan for. If there are a few insurrections that are devoid of weapons. But that having been said, this commission that has been set up that she's trying to set up, obviously, it's unprecedented. Now, it is a select committee, but, you know, it, generally speaking, each side picks its members of a select committee. And in an unprecedented fashion, the speaker has decided that certain members on the Republican side will not be allowed to be seated on the commission. And I think it just goes to show that this is simply political warfare being used by the Speaker of the House to turn the Republic into a banana republic. This is an inquisition, a one-sided inquisition used to vanquish, sully, and destroy your political adversaries and rivals. And in my opinion, that's all that this commission is intended to do.
Congressman, we have to leave it at that. This is vital work, and I appreciate your clarity on it. And we hope you'll come back to us with updates about it. And in the meantime, thank you for the work you do on so many fronts. I know you'll keep it up, and Godspeed as you do so. Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, always happy to chat.
Thank you. Great to be with you today.
Next up, we'll speak with somebody else right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is a senior fellow, I'm pleased to say, of the Center for Security Policy, the director of jihadwatch.org, a tremendously important online resource that is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. The author of, well, I think it's 24 books now, including most recently an important book for the Center for Security Policy entitled Islamophobia and the Threat to Free Speech. His name, of course, is Robert Spencer, and I'm happy to follow him, as I hope you will, at JihadWatchRS. Robert, it's good to have you back in-house virtually. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Always good to talk to you, Frank.
Thank you. You have several important pieces on your site at the moment that I wanted to just sort of touch upon, because I think there's kind of a common denominator to a number of them. And this is not unique to today's posts, needless to say, Robert. You've been chronicling this for years and years. But a lack of coherence on the part of many in government, particularly ours, about the nature of jihad, what we're up against, what it portends. And one of the things that you've used to sort of address that topic is the recent release from Guantanamo Bay of a jihadist. And you point out that his detention for almost 20 years was a function of this kind of incoherence. Walk us through your thoughts on this, Robert, and this will set up a longer conversation about the nature of jihad and why we still don't get it.
Absolutely, Frank. Abdul Latif Nasser was a member of the Taliban, arrested in Afghanistan, and he's been in Guantanamo for 19 years. He was just released, never charged. Apparently, there was no crime that he could be connected to, but he wouldn't have been picked up if he hadn't been involved in some Taliban activities. And the problem is that this was just the way that the United States and other countries have always operated when they're dealing in a war. They arrest or capture enemy combatants, put them in prison camps, and then at the end of the war, they're sent back home. This happened with Germans, many of whom were held in the United States, and others all through American history. And the problem here is that this was not actually pursued as a war. These people were captured like soldiers, but then there was no end point for them to be released. And because they had not been engaged in any discernible criminal activity other than opposing the United States on the battlefield, there was nothing much that they could be charged with. And so some of them were charged when there was something, and it was treated, the fight against jihad was treated as criminal activity. And some of them, like Abdul Latif Nasser, just languished in prison as if they were prisoners of war, although there was never any time that they could be conveniently released because there was never any end to the jihad. And this is the conceptual problem that the United States has faced. The jihad is a 1,400-year struggle. The United States doesn't want to admit that because it doesn't even want to admit there's a jihad. And so it's had an incredible amount of trouble defining what exactly it was we were doing in Afghanistan, what we're doing in general in the so-called war on terror, how it will end, how it could possibly end, and what to do with the combatants.
This, again, elevates the topic that I think is evident in several other of your posts at the moment. A German jihadist who actually murdered three people has been remanded to a psychiatric hospital. An Indian film has been produced that is seemingly all about jihad as personal struggle. And indeed, Afghanistan itself, we've just simply essentially pulled the plug on our participation in that conflict without any regard for the probability, I think the certitude really, that jihadists both in that country and elsewhere will be emboldened by what we're doing. Walk us through how this, you know, policy approach, if you can call it that, is really fraught as we see it.
Well, you know, the problem is the jihad doctrine, the idea that Muslims should wage war against unbelievers, is embedded in the Quran and the law of Islam and the example of Muhammad. And so there are some Muslims who have always taken it up throughout history, and some, of course, who never have and never will. But it is embedded in Islamic doctrine. Consequently,
specifically Sharia, right?
Exactly. So the difficulty comes in when you have this case, such as in Germany that you mentioned, what to do with this fellow when the German government doesn't want to acknowledge that there is this jihad, because apparently they worry that it will get them embroiled in some larger conflict if they do admit it. And the Western governments in general, including that of the United States, seem to have agreed on that. So the Germans have decided, apparently, that jihadis, and this fellow is unarguably a jihadi, he screamed Allahu Akbar while he was killing these people. He was following ISIS recommendations. He said to police that he was engaged in a jihad. And they still decided he was mentally ill because they have no legal concepts. They have no way to admit that such a thing exists. And this is the same kind of problem that left Abdel Latif Nasser languishing in Guantanamo for 19 years, that we are facing an enemy that we dare not define properly or name as he calls himself.
And what are the implications of that, Robert? I mean, you've studied the doctrine of Sharia and the jihad it commands very closely, arguably as well as anybody, certainly in the non-Muslim world. You have been a very close observer of, and critic of, for that matter, U.S. policy throughout this period, since before 9/11, but particularly in its aftermath. What are the implications of persisting in getting this so fundamentally wrong? Again, example being what is unfolding before our eyes in Afghanistan at the moment.
Well, one of the main ones is that we will be blindsided by threats that we didn't see coming. And we will exaggerate threats from other things that are not really that much of a big deal. And we see that with, of course, this white supremacist nonsense that's being spread by the FBI and others today. But meanwhile, there are groups in the United States that are linked to the Muslim Brotherhood, as the center has so well delineated. And they have tremendous influence in Washington, because in Washington, there's just no idea that an Islamic group could be working by peaceful means to extend the influence of Sharia. That's just not a concept they're willing to consider in the slightest degree. And when it comes to Afghanistan, of course, the idea was to create a Western-style secular republic. And that also came about because of a fundamental misunderstanding of Sharia, its hold on a population like that of Afghanistan, and how difficult it would be to dislodge and replace.
You know, it's interesting you say that we have not contemplated a sort of peaceful form of jihad aimed at the same ultimate end state, namely world domination by Sharia-adherent Muslims. But we're also talking about not really having clarity about the violent kind of jihad either. It's profoundly demoralizing that we continue to be so seemingly clueless about the nature of the enemy and the various techniques that are being pursued to advance its agenda. This is, of course, part and parcel of the influence operations that are being run against us by notably adherence to the Muslim Brotherhood's program. And I happened last week, Robert Spencer, to be in and around the International Religious Freedom Summit that was essentially sponsored by a good friend, Ambassador Sam Brownback. And a prominent figure in its proceedings is a man who has been a leader for many years of the Muslim Brotherhood North America, namely an imam by the name of Muhammad Majid, who runs a very large mosque complex here in the Northern Virginia area called the Adams Center. Just give us a quick course on the Muslim Brotherhood, if you would, and the role that it has been playing in this kind of stealthy jihad. I think you coined that phrase some years ago, Robert. And specifically, if you would, the irony of having one of its leading operatives at an event where, among other things, the persecution of people of faith, namely Christians particularly, the vastly largest number of people who are being persecuted for their religious beliefs in the world today, some 340 million of them being heavily persecuted, according to a group called Open Doors. Give us a little background on Muhammad Majid, if you would, and more broadly, the stealth jihad and its impact on our lack of clarity about the dangers we're facing from that quarter.
Muhammad Majid is a former head of the Islamic Society of North America, which is a very powerful, widespread, influential Islamic group in Washington and in Canada as well. And it is a Muslim Brotherhood-linked organization. The Brotherhood is dedicated worldwide to imposing Sharia on non-Islamic states and bringing about what it views as the conquest of the victory of Islam. And the difficulty that somebody like former Senator Brownback has and others is that the there is no idea, there's just the assumption that Islam is in every respect a religion and solely a religion like Judaism and Christianity. And there is no recognition of the political aspects of Islam that the Brotherhood is trying and working in numerous ways around the world to further. And consequently, they feel incumbent upon them to include someone like Mohammed Majid in these interfaith initiatives without realizing that for him, for Mohammed Majid, there's just no doubt that he subscribes to the same view of interfaith dialogue as held by the Muslim Brotherhood theorist Sayyid Qutb, who said that, yes, we should build bridges to non-Muslims, which is exactly the terminology that all the participants in interfaith dialogue use. And he said those bridges, however, must be understood as one way. They are designed to lead the non-Muslims to Islam. In other words, they're not really designed from the Brotherhood's point of view to bring about any genuine interfaith harmony or peaceful coexistence or anything of that kind. They're just means of proselytization. But this is something that nobody in the West has acknowledged.
And to the extent that they've not acknowledged it, it's actually the case, I know certainly in this country and I think elsewhere, Robert Spencer, that they've compounded the problem by having people like Mohammed Majid not only addressing interfaith dialogue events like this summit last week, but advising our government, notably during the Obama years as a prominent member of the Department of Homeland Security Advisory Committee, in which capacity he and I think several other Muslim Brotherhood tied individuals had a profound impact on coining and popularizing and actually kind of mandating this concept of countering violent extremism. And you might just remind us as to what that was all about and how it has had lingering effects. I mean, even today, where we're hearing a lot about the threat of white supremacists being the most serious danger that we face in the homeland, is very much a byproduct, it seems to me, of Mohammed Majid and others like him, their efforts to, you know, have us focus not on jihadist elements inside the United States, let alone, you know, other threats like the Antifas and the Black Lives Matter and the Marxists more generally, but rather these Trump voters.
Yes, well, see, this is the insidious aspect of the whole countering violent extremism initiative. The Obama administration oversaw the removal of all mention of Islam and jihad from counterterror training and replaced it with vague references to an undefined extremism. Now, it's extremely insidious, actually, after the Southern Poverty Law Center laid the groundwork by terming foes of jihad terror, like you and me, Frank, as extremists. They laid the groundwork for terming anyone who opposes the administration's agenda, the current administration, as an extremist. And this is an extremely dangerous period we've entered in American history, where there seems to be a concerted effort on the part of the people in power to actually criminalize and silence political opposition in a way that's fundamentally against the principles of this nation.
Indeed, this is a distinct threat, I believe, to, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of thought, even in our country, Robert Spencer. And we appreciate so much your contributions to all of those things and your courage in standing up against the sort of cumulative efforts of those like the Southern Poverty Law Center, a political warfare instrument, I believe, in the hands of our adversaries, whether it's the jihadists or whether it's the Marxists or the red-green axis that brings them together. Thank you for the great work you do, Robert, including for the Center for Security Policy as one of its senior fellows. It's deeply appreciated, and I know you will keep up the great work you do at jihadwatch.org. Please check that out as a bookmarked online resource for you all, folks. Next up, we'll speak with Michael Pack, the former chief executive of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, about Beyond Bias, the world of censorship we've now entered. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we are joined by Michael Pack. He is a highly acclaimed documentary filmmaker with, among other credits, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words, a really beautiful documentary tribute to one of our most distinguished, I think, consequential Supreme Court justices. He was, until recently, the chief executive officer for the U.S. Agency for Global Media, and he's authored an op-ed in the Washington Examiner about some of his experiences in that role, and I'm very pleased to have a chance to catch up with him. It's entitled Beyond Bias. Michael Pack, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be back with you.
So this was a very poignant, the French would call it, I think, cri de coeur in a way, an expression of deep frustration and not a little anguish from what happened to you during your time, trying to essentially right the ship, I think it's fair to say, at the Agency for Global Media. Talk a little bit about the operation that you inherited and what you were trying to do, and then we'll get into how you were buffeted, to put it mildly, by the media in what it seems to me was really information warfare against you.
Well, as you know, Frank, the U.S. Agency for Global Media is the parent organization of all of U.S. International broadcasting, and it includes the five broadcasters: Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Cuba Broadcasting, Middle East Broadcasting Networks, and Radio Free Asia. And they have a budget of about $850 million a year, and they reach an audience of 350 million people globally every week. They broadcast in 70 languages all over the world. They say that they're one of the biggest collectively, they're one of the biggest broadcasters in the world, and they're a powerful force. And they're intended to be a force promoting American ideas and institutions, particularly important now when our ideas are under attack from China and our other adversaries around the world. And I found when I got there, after a long and bruising confirmation process, that they were very 3 years and 3 months, you know, I think close to a record. But the Democrats did not want me to take this over. They like to control the media, and these agencies are bound by law to be objective, comprehensive, balanced, reflect all the views in the American political spectrum, to promote American ideas and institutions. And they were simply not doing that. I mean, they were just like another government-funded CNN at best, and more like another international NPR. And why should the American people be paying for that? I mean, and so my goal was to try to get them simply to fulfill the law, to make them live up to the law and do what they were required to do. And as soon as I started doing that, the attacks came. The media was only one aspect, but on the Hill, from Democrats and Republicans, these people had a whole network of nonprofit, pro bono lawyers, and they kind of sued the agency, and it was an endless battle. My piece in the Examiner focused on just the media component of that, but I think that is a very telling aspect of it. And I call it Beyond Bias because it's not right to call the media bias anymore. It is so much past that. As I say in the article, the bias was when the old days, Frank, when you and I were growing up, and there were three television networks and a couple big newspapers that were very influential, and they would present two sides of the story, but they would favor the side they agreed with. They would give them the best lines. They'd let them begin and end. But buried in the piece was the other side they didn't agree with. Now that other side has vanished, and it's simply advocacy. In the 8 months I ran the USAGM,
out and out right advocacy.
It's Some people call it propaganda, maybe a better word. And in the 8 months that I was running USAGM, there were over 40 pieces in the Washington Post, you know, incredible amount. And for somebody who is not a cabinet member, including
40 pieces about you and your management of this agency.
40 pieces about me and the horrible stuff I was doing at USAGM, and including three editorials and four op-eds. You know, they thought any attempt to sort of fix this was just a huge injustice. But in those 40 pieces, they never interviewed anybody who agreed with me. There was no way a reader could understand why we did what we did. Only the people who attacked us. So it was not biased. It was simply pieces about that.
Let's talk about some of the, you know, dramatis personae, as they say, the people involved in, first of all, your agency prior to your arrival, who migrated on or simply took advantage of relationships that facilitated these sorts of attacks, including by the Washington Post.
Well, that's right. I mean, the two institutions that attacked us most were Washington Post and NPR. I mean, we were also attacked, of course, the New York Times, Politico, CNN, et cetera. But the two big ones were the Post and NPR. And the person who I forced out as director of the Voice of America, Amanda Bennett, married to Don Graham, who used to own the Washington Post, and they still have connections to the Washington Post. And Amanda Bennett penned one of these op-eds attacking me and did not, of course, mention her connection to the Post. But there it is. And the NPR connection is even closer. My predecessor, who was not Senate confirmed, but he was still had the CEO title, John Lansing, left USAGM to be president of NPR during the time when all these attacks occurred. And not only that, Frank, but we were investigating the flaws of these people's administration. It's not just that they happen to have this association. John Lansing, you know, the things that went awry under these people's watch. And we were investigating things, including a massive security problem for which they are responsible. So they had every interest in shutting us down.
Suppressing you, terminating you if they could. And this contributed, of course, to that epic delay in your confirmation. And I just want to say, Michael, I think it is a great testament to your character and your courage and your tenacity that you put up with the 3 years and 3 months of character assassination and, you know, slow rolling, including by Republicans who at the time were running the Senate. It's just a real indictment of what I think of as kind of the controlled opposition that they represent up there. But Michael, let me just ask you, because what you've really described here is kind of a microcosm of what happened to the Trump administration and President Trump most especially, writ large. And in a way, it's very helpful to have it be on a somewhat smaller scale because you can really see how the larger dynamic operated. What you've really described here seems to me to be information operations in support of out-and-out political warfare.
I think that is really so. I think my story is very much a microcosm. And you could tell in the other things that are beyond bias. I described in the article that particularly David Folkenflik, but others too, we're willing to do things that I think run counter to at NPR, thank you, run counter to sort of standard, what used to be journalistic ethics. I mean, they were willing to print things they knew to be false. And then beyond that, he printed stuff about the personal lives of three or four of the people working for me, you know, sort of mid-level people or a little senior supporters to me, but there were people in their 30s. He would talk about messy divorces they had. He would talk about problems they had with their family.
Doxing, I think, is sort of the generic term for them.
It had nothing to do with international broadcasting. We begged him not to put them in, my communications team. He said, well, the public has a right to know. But what's the purpose of talking about? One of them had his father took out a temporary restraining order on him. And so what is the point of putting that in a piece about international broadcasting? The only purpose was to scare and terrorize these people. And it worked. They were in tears. Character assassination. This young man was in tears, couldn't work the next day, and he was fearful from then on, because he knew that whenever he applied for a job, people would Google his name and up the stuff would come. They were afraid, and the purpose was to make them afraid. There was just, it isn't even journalism.
So, Michael, this saga and what befell you and your colleagues as you, again, tried to get this government agency to simply conform to its statutory mandate is symptomatic of what is being done under the guise of journalism writ large, oftentimes, and most egregiously by entities like National Public Radio or NPR that has its own mandate for objectivity and gets government subsidies because it is supposed to perform according to those standards and does not. Again, I listen to it fairly regularly and am often astonished by the extent to which it is simply propounding a highly partisan narrative, oftentimes simply as fact or as news, and it is a real disservice to the American people that it does so.
That is really true. As you know, Frank, I've spent my life really in public broadcasting. I've spent decades producing documentaries, all broadcast nationally on PBS. I was a senior vice president of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And it's shocking and shameful that NPR has descended so low. I mean, and as you said, I mean, it's one thing to be attacked by the Washington Post, a private organization, but NPR gets public money. It has a similar legal requirement to the Voice of America. It has to present objective and balanced reporting, and it simply is failing to do that. Should the American people support it? And in the case of NPR, it's not only the number amount of money, it's they get to be National Public Radio. It gives them the seal of approval. Is it right? I mean, I agree with you that it is a disgrace.
It reflects to some extent the similar problem that you were addressing with some of these other international broadcast outlets. In the name of balance under the previous regime, they were endlessly promoting out and outright propaganda from America's enemies. Certainly not what those who, you know, established the AGM, or for that matter, the various organizations it oversees, had in mind. No.
Well, that is right. I mean, it is failing to fulfill its actually important mission of promoting American ideas and institutions. But the point with NPR is that we are also not communicating those ideas to the sort of young people of today. We are not, more and more people grow up not understanding the principles this country was founded on in this own country, let alone abroad.
Or actually loathing them, as the case may be, as part of the sort of Maoist critical race theory, as it's called, or racist indoctrination. Hey, Michael, before we lose all of our time with you, let me just ask you about a sort of broader question. You have been in this space for most of your professional life. You understand firsthand how important freedom of speech is. I just invite you to talk a little bit about what we're witnessing happening to our country beyond, you know, what roles these various journalists or news outlets are playing, social media, among other things. And now a sort of collusion with the government, or even in some cases with the Democratic National Committee, for heaven's sakes, to suppress freedom of speech, to suppress what people are able to get access to on the internet in the name of, denying fake news or false information, misinformation from being disseminated. Give us your sort of critical analysis of where we are and where we're headed.
I think it is a very, very serious, troubling threat to our republic. I mean, in a microcosm, I experienced a little of this myself. I, as you mentioned, my company produced Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in his own words, which was on PBS, documentary about Justice Thomas, got great critical reviews, and it was streaming on Amazon until they ceased streaming it early in February, Black History Month. They took it off the air. They canceled it instead of what you'd expect, that they'd list it. You know, in the old days, right, they'd list five sort of critical race theory documentaries recommended for Black History Month, and one maybe with a different point of view. Now nothing. And in fact, they took it off. And they claim it's just it was just an algorithm thing, but they have never put it back on. And people have complained. There have been articles in the Wall Street Journal. 19 senators wrote to them about it. they don't need to put it back on. They can do whatever they want. The arrogance is amazing. And now, as you say, Frank, the latest twist, taking direction from the government, is astounding. I mean, the idea that these people have this Section 230 protection, continue to have that, in spite of their doing more and more, not just acting as a publisher, but acting as a particularly irresponsible publisher, is amazing. I think that we need to, you know, but the thing I think about the media, just to make a concluding thought, is it's never going to go back to journalistic standards in the old days. I think we have to deal with the fact that we are facing what I don't like to call it the mainstream media, left-wing media on one side, and then there's, if you want to call it, conservative right-wing media on the other. And we need to just strip away from these people, these institutions, the idea that they are not simply partisan propagandists. You know, we have to not give them the credit and pretend that they're somehow still adhere to journalistic standards. And that goes for social media, too.
Yes, it does. Identify their biases, hold them accountable for them, and discount what they're saying as a result of that bias. These are eminently sensible approaches. Michael Pack, thank you for all you've done, both in the public sector and in your private capacity, to advance the freedom of information and to ensure that we all have access to it and or are getting our money's worth when we pay for it in terms of our foreign broadcasting. I know you'll keep up the good work with your documentary filmmaking at Manifold Productions, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Even before Joe Biden's alarming performance in a CNN town hall event on Wednesday, a recent poll found 56% of the American people believe he is not in charge. That percentage can only have grown further in its aftermath. If Mr. Biden isn't actually performing as our nation's chief executive, who is? Since the agenda being shoved down our throats in his name is so radical, we have an urgent need to know. Sadly, none of the obvious candidates inspire much confidence. Vice President Kamala Harris, White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain, Domestic Policy Advisor Susan Rice, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, and even former President Barack Obama all have records of dishonesty, bad judgment, and/or sheer incompetence. Our country is in deep trouble. We're entitled at the very least to learn who to hold accountable for running it into the ground. This is Frank Gaffney. This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.